Thank you, Neil. And I think this talk is going to be different from most of the other talks in two ways. The first is that I'm actually going to mention tidal disruptions, which I think is not otherwise a greatly popular subject with this group. But I'm going to use it, in the end, to motivate consideration of a more basic problem in accretion, which, as Neil said, I think actually is of broader interest. And what's going to be different about that part is that I'll offer absolutely no answers. In fact, this is a topic that I think is so open that the interesting questions are, what's really the right way to go about exploring it? And I hope that will provoke discussion and comments. I'll just say that my collaborators and I are just getting started on it, and there are a lot of real basic questions about even the way to pose the problem. So, and having said that, I should remark that in the first part, specifically about tidal disruptions, that collaborator with Gilad Svirsky, then a postdoc with Tzvi Piran. In the new part, Gilad is no longer a postdoc with Tzvi, but Edwin Chan is, and so he's taking up the reins on it. Okay, so I want to begin by thinking about just how grateful we should be for the simplicities of ordinary circular accretion disks. They have a lot of nice properties that really make our lives easier. And you're all familiar with the arguments for why they should be circular, namely that it's easy to cool, it's easy to get rid of energy by radiation, and radiation is very inefficient at carrying away angular momentum. So the result is a system with the least energy for a given amount of angular momentum, and that is a circular orbit. And there are many benefits to this. This, on average, the system's axisymmetric. That's wonderful. The shear is constant as you go around your orbit. Only one component of the stress, either the shear tensor or the stress tensor, is relevant, r phi. We know exactly what happens in terms of the angular momentum budget and the energy budget. You have a certain amount of stress between rings. They exert a torque. There is an associated amount of work with that. And the part that's in excess of contributing to orbital energy goes into turbulence and then is dissipated into heat. And then ultimately maybe photons. But there is a unique relationship between specific angular momentum and energy. And as I said, context here, the axisymmetry means that the density and the pressure, on average, don't vary around the orbit. You know, there are all kinds of little fluctuations, but there is a well-defined, time-steady average that should be very closely axisymmetric. And those are the valuable set of simplifications that I was referring to. But as Neil said, although certainly circular disks are the most common case, they're not absolutely universal. There are a variety of tidal effects in, for example, cataclysmic variables, where they're associated with superhumps, and there is an understanding that these are eccentric disturbances in the outer regions of the disks. You can get other tidal effects due to planets. You can also see eccentricity in rapidly rotating BE stars. But the eccentricity in all three of those cases tends to be relatively mild. And what got me interested in this subject is a completely different way, has nothing to do with tidal effect. Well, even getting it started has to do with tidal effects. That if you create a disk suddenly, and you just dump mass around some gravitating object, and you set it up in whatever peculiar orbital arrangement you choose, then that could be eccentric. It's going to be almost intrinsically a transient situation, but transients can be interesting. And in particular, that's what happens in tidal disruptions. So there, the tide takes place right at the beginning, doesn't affect the subsequent evolution of the disk, but what it does do is to create a system that's intrinsically not just eccentric, but highly eccentric, with eccentricities very nearly unity. and a set one that's intrinsically transient. Now, because probably very few of you who are familiar with tidal disruptions, let me run you through the arguments for why they present such an extreme and interesting case of eccentric accretion flows. Basic story is that you can easily estimate the tidal radius for a star approaching a much more massive object, like, for example, a black hole. You know, the formalism is really the same as determining the tidal radius for anything. You can break up a self-gravitating object, another one, when it passes closely enough that the orbital frequency matches the, or exceeds, the fundamental vibrational frequency, the dynamical frequency of the little object. And so it's basically a density ratio, and that's why the tidal radius is the radius of the star times the cube root of the ratio of masses between the black hole and the star. For typical numbers, that cube root, well, the mass ratio is 10 to the 6, so the cube root is about 100, and you get about 100 times the radius of a star. Now, if you ask, what is the distribution of mass and energy and angular momentum for the material of the disrupted star? There's actually a very insightful, essentially dimensional argument that was invented by Martin Rees, it's now coming on 30 years ago, which is that there's only one natural energy scale in this problem, and that's the tidal change in potential energy at the edges of the star as it passes through the paracenter. And I'm going to identify the paracenter with the tidal radius because that's always going to be the most common case. Other than that, there are no characteristic energy scales, and so he guessed that what would happen, because the star is coming in on a parabolic orbit, the center of mass motion has zero energy, the result would be to create a mass distribution that's flat with energy from minus E star to plus E star. Basically, half of the mass unbound, half of the mass bound, and the most deeply bound material would have a bonding energy of order E star. Nearly all the mass, however, would have the same specific angular momentum, the angular momentum of the star in its initial orbit. Okay. Now, this is a color contour plot of a detailed calculation of a tidal disruption, and what it shows is that basically Martin's guess was right on the money, with only very small adjustments. This is a logarithmic color scale, so this color is large, this color is low. Specific energy here in fractional departure from the mean. And what you can see is that the bound material here has maybe 10% less specific angular momentum than the mean. The unbound has about 10% more. So it's pretty close, being right on the mean. The energy scale here, this is difference in energy compared to that, basically that E star number. And you'll see this is now on a much bigger scale. That's 1 here, 0 to minus 1 and 0 to plus 1. And indeed, the mass is pretty evenly distributed across that range of energies here and continue here for the unbound part. And there's a really sharp break there and there. So this approximation of a square wave mass with energy distribution is actually quite good. So you can immediately go from that to estimating the semi-major axis of the orbit taken by this most bound material, and that's another cube root of the mass ratio times the tidal radius, so about 100 times the tidal radius. But of course the material has only the angular momentum of the star, very close to that initial J-star. And the result is an eccentricity that's 1 minus roughly the inverse of that mass ratio. So within a percent or two of unity. Very, very highly eccentric. another way of phrasing this is that compared to the binding energy of a circular orbit with that specific angular momentum, this material is, on average, much less bound. It has much too much energy for that angular momentum if you're comparing it to a circular orbit. Now, in much of the phenomenological work on this subject, people sort of wave their hands and say, it'll immediately form a classical circular accretion disk because we know how to deal with them. That's easier said than done. And because basically we've got a system where the binding energy is 100 times smaller than it needs to be in order to form itself into a circle. So a lot of energy has to be gotten rid of somehow. And the most common hand-waving argument, which also goes back to the same Nature letter, is that if you measure the tidal radius and gravitational radii of the black hole, it's not a huge number. So the material comes around, and relativistic apsidal precession will swing the orientation of the ellipse so that the material crosses itself. And then there'd be shocks, and the shocks would dissipate the orbital energy, and you'd be off and running. The problem is, if you look at that more quantitatively, the apsidal precession is not really that strong in most cases. If the tidal radius is larger than about 10 in gravitational units, there are some shocks near the paracenter, which I'll describe momentarily, but they're rather weak. And the actual stream crossings created by the apsidal precession occur out near apocenter, not near paracenter. And at apocenter, the kinetic energy available is very small, and that's the energy you have available to dissipate in a shock. So it's not very good. Those shocks are not very good at changing orbital energy into heat. And I can sort of imagine you're taking your fingers and making an extended ellipse and then swinging it a little bit. You can see this, the geometric point, that if the precession is only 10, 20 degrees, that where you intersect is way out here, not way inside. You need to get a precession of something like a radian or a pile or two in order to get strong intersections. Now, even if the tidal radius is that small, so in fact the stuff does wrap around strongly, then what happens is that, yes, there are strong shocks, and the orbital energy is transmuted into heat, but now what you have is a very hot pressure-supported system. You don't have a conventional flat circular accretion disk there either. So you just can't win. And what motivated us was thinking about the more common case where the system goes into this very, very eccentric flow and finds it difficult to dissipate the orbital energy. Yes, what happens then? Give you a sense of, a little more sense in detail of what actually happens. These are two cartoons drawn from a detailed numerical hydrodynamics simulation showing what actually happens to these streams in a fairly generic kind of situation. I should caution that this is in Schwarzschild space-time, so we don't have to worry about out-of-plane lens tearing precession, etc. So we have this broad energy distribution, the flat top that I mentioned before. And of course, that corresponds to an orbital period distribution. We know how to do that, just semi-major axis in energy. So that after an initial fairly sharp rise on about the time scale of the orbital period of the most bound material, the rate at which mass returns from long distance falls off as a power law that should be roughly t to the minus 5/3. That extends for a long time. So you have continuous resupply of material, although the accretion right here tapers off over time. The early arriving material comes in, and there is a weak shock near paracenter. It's not strictly speaking at paracenter, but close. Where that comes from is that the star has finite vertical extent. So these streams aren't exactly in the orbital plane. As they come back from either side of the orbital plane, approaching paracenter, those streams converge, and there's a shock between them as they approach the paracenter region. But it's a weak shock because the opening angle of that convergence is rather small, and of course all you have available is the relative velocity, not the total. So the stuff then sweeps back out, going and gets out very nearly to what would have been its original apocenter, and there it runs into the late arriving material. So there's a pair of shocks here, forward and reverse. And that's, I think, intuitively fairly natural. What's maybe a little bit more surprising is that over time, another shock forms over here. It's still, crudely speaking, on the semi-major axis scale rather than the paracenter scale, much smaller paracenter scale, but there are more shocks. And as I emphasized before, the amount of energy available to dissipate is not very large compared to the potential energy available at the paracenter.
Where does the shock come from, the 2B? How is it formed?
The result of the shock, the pressure in here rises. So material coming up in here ends up being slowed down here and shocking. And then that sort of splits off, and the material reaccelerates and shocks again. So now, how does this material ever get in close to the black hole, where maybe it might actually radiate something? Roughly speaking, the tidal radius, as we measure in gravitational units, is not very big. It's several tens for typical numbers. Bigger than 10, but by factors of 3 or 5, not factors of 100. Now, if you calculate the specific angular momentum associated with that kind of paracenter for a parabolic orbit, you get about 6.5 in gravitational units. By contrast, the specific angular momentum required for zero energy material to just plunge straight through the ISCO is 4. It's not much of a difference. To illustrate what's going on, the plot here, which shows the effective potential as a function of specific angular momentum, 12 for traversal space-time is the angular momentum of the ISCO. So you can see the sort of flat shelf here corresponding to the ISCO. Here, J is a little bit less than 4. Here it's a little more than 4, 4.5 or so. And if you imagine particle coming in with just under, with an energy that's, its rest mass minus epsilon, it can pass over this peak in the effective potential, the one corresponding to that number, and plunge straight in. If the angular momentum were higher, between 4 and 6.5, this sort of 5.5, then it still hits a centrifugal barrier before that prevents it from going in further. So that raises the thought that if, as the material circulates around, it can somehow lose just a third or so of its angular momentum, then it could plunge straight in and essentially not radiate at all. It could be an interesting result. And the question is whether that process happens faster or slower than the process of gradually losing energy in that accretion flow by sort of the usual array of processes we're familiar with, namely the eventual development of internal stresses from MHD process, MHD turbulence, and perhaps also deflection of those shocks. So we've done some scaling arguments, and these are quite rough. You can find all this. The third revision of the paper was posted to AstroPH, I don't know, 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago. You can read about it there. These are rough guesswork scaling arguments, but the sort of gist of it is that if work is done at a rate that's basically the stress times the rate of shear, the rate at which work is done, and therefore lost from the orbit, essentially, is rather strongly concentrated to the paracenter. But the streams don't spend very long near paracenter. They spend most of their time in the apicenter. And by contrast, the loss of angular momentum, modulo geometric factor, is basically proportional to the stress. And so when we compared how they scaled with progress around the orbit, what we found is that there's something of an advantage, actually, to angular momentum loss. And that's particularly, I should say, in this context, it's particularly because to lose the amount of angular momentum that's an interesting amount to lose, as I said, is only tens of percent of the original, whereas it's a factor of order unity, in fact, actually closer to a factor of 100, actually, get all the way down to the circular orbit near the tidal radius, you lose 99% of the energy to get to circularize close in. So you don't need to remove, in fractional terms, nearly as much angular momentum as you do need to remove the amount of energy. So
the angular momentum is lost from the flow to what?
To other mass. And yes, that stays in the system. But remember that the stuff has very little angular momentum. So in a sense, it doesn't have very much to lose, which means that even when you've given this much angular momentum, that's one-third, to the great majority of, I said that backwards, even when you've removed that one-third from the great majority of the mass, it doesn't have a huge effect on the remainder that soaks it up, because there's basically not that much to give. Okay, and in that, if that's the situation, maybe stuff really does just go straight in fairly quickly. And that's actually observationally desirable because these tidal disruption events are bright, but they're actually not nearly as bright as people expected them to be. A couple of orders of magnitude down. So it's an interesting speculative answer to possibly to why the luminosity is lower than expected. Now, I've papered over one of the two interesting questions people like to ask. One of them is the one that Jean-Pierre just asked, so that's taken care of. The other one is that when the material does lose angular momentum but is still orbiting, its paracenter does get pretty close, and at that point, apsidal precession should get more interesting. So the material will wrap around and then start shocking against other material fairly close in. And the question is, what happens there? Now, this is something that, without a detailed simulation, it's very hard for us to do much more than hand wave and guess. Shocks are very good at redistributing angular momentum because streams get deflected sideways sometimes, and that is a change in angular momentum. If you imagine there's material coming here and stuff that wraps around and hits this, the mass of the other material you expect would be enough to deflect the stream mostly inward, or possibly even upward, where of course there's always going to be less mass to block its motion. There is one simulation on this subject that kind of an overlaps in conditions with what we're envisioning here. This is done by Oleg Sandowski, where he actually sees stuff being deflected vertically. So that's something of an open question, and it will certainly affect how things progress quantitatively. It's unclear whether it really changes the sort of long-term answer. But there's also a more basic question. And this is the point where I want to turn from the motivation about this interesting thing that happens in really extremely eccentric disks produced by tidal disruptions to the more basic accretion physics questions. The way that we imagine the material losing its 30% of angular momentum as it goes around, that is through these conventional internal stresses. But this is a system that hasn't lived very long. We're talking about material that's gone through its orbit only a few times. And there is a real question about, well, if it is magnetorotationally unstable, has it time to saturate? And in fact, how does the MRI grow in the case of a highly elliptical orbit where the local shear is changing all the time? There might also be additional effects special to elliptical disks beyond just whatever they do to the MRI growth rate. And in this regard, there actually is some literature. Not a lot. If it's more than a dozen or 15 papers altogether, I'd be surprised. But let me give you a quick summary of what it says and sort of how it relates to these problems. So I want to go back to making these contrasts between elliptical and circular disks. This is the list of circular simplifications that showed before at the beginning. And of course, none of them applies to elliptical orbits. They're all gone, every single one of those. And what we do know, and between those four names, I think accounted for a very large fraction of the 15 or so papers on the subject. Jeremy was there in the early days. Shoji Kato back in the 1980s, and more recently, and particularly Gordon Ogilvy, who's been pushing this along, with some interesting work by John Papaloisi. And to summarize this story very briefly, there are some interesting, specifically hydrodynamic effects to flow in eccentric disks. First, the internal pressure gradients can drive a precession in orientation of the orbits. It tends to be fairly slow in many cases, but it's still there. A second is that a lot of properties vary periodically as material travels around its orbit. The streams diverge and come back, so there's a pressure modulation there. The vertical gravity, of course, changes as you go around the orbit and come back. And the result is that there are some wave modes that can be excited by parametric application in an exponentially growing fashion. Third is that if you start playing with a phenomenological alpha model style stress, then under certain circumstances, that too can cause growing, actually overstable oscillations. But surely, if you think about the places where the alpha model is reasonable and the places where you really shouldn't trust it, this is one that goes way beyond its sort of initial justification. And I would think alpha stresses would be especially unreliable here, which raises the question about, which I'll get to in a moment, but isn't it time we started thinking of just what MHD might do here? But before I get to those questions, I want to digress for a moment about a very nice result due to Gordon Ogilvy that can, for certain kinds of investigations, can provide, I think, a good background. And that is, he's produced a sort of generalized shearing box model appropriate to eccentric disks. Basic idea is that you construct a set of coordinates modeled on conventional cylindrical coordinates, in the sense that you have a planar system with an azimuthal angle, and you have a vertical coordinate. They're untouched. But instead of thinking in terms of circular radius, instead you lay down a set of nested ellipses, each one labeled with its semilattice rectum P. And that quantity P replaces the role of the radius in cylindrical coordinates. Now, with that in hand, you can choose your grid to have an eccentricity that's some function of P. There are constraints on exactly what this relationship is that are posed by the requirement of not letting the orbits intersect. Magnitude eccentricity and a rotation of orientation can also be built in. And now imagine that from this set of nested orbits, you choose a particular one, they're called P naught, and look at that as the center of this quasi-shearing box. Sort of ride along with the way it travels, and then you look at the shear surrounding that local location. What's different here is that, as I said, all these properties vary periodically as you ride around. The shear changes, the vertical gravity changes, the local pressure changes. But it does provide a nice framework for working, and you can conveniently derive the relevant equations by coordinate transformations in the spirit of relativistic coordinate transformations. You know, if you go to a peculiar coordinate frame, then you get these extra funny looking terms in the equations of motion having to do with the connections. You can derive those in exactly the same way you would for, instead of relativistic coordinate transformation. So it has the potential to be a nice sandbox for looking at this in ways as an analogous to the shearing box approach. Okay, so now returning to the question about MHD, start thinking about all the different ways that the familiar MRI mechanics would be modified in eccentric disks. So not only is the rate of shear no longer constant, it's no longer directly connected to the orbital frequency, because there's shear in the radial component as well as in phi dot. That also means that the relationship between torque and work changes. Presumably, with these periodically time-dependent coefficients and parameters, the growth of the MRI is no longer a simple exponential. We'll see. That's a presumably. I don't know. It's possible that it may be subject to these parametric application effects, much like the acoustic waves found in hydrodynamics. And in fact, those acoustic waves don't necessarily go away, just because there are also magnetic fields. And there could be interesting interactions between the different kinds of modes. Again, not present at all in conventional circular disks. The last of them is that, in a sense, the analog of dynamics on the inflow time scale, in this case, is evolution of the eccentricity profile. And certainly opportunity here for moving both angular momentum and energy through the system. And it would be an interesting question whether all these various effects accentuate the eccentricity, diminish it, move it around, reorient it. Unclear. So now we get to the point that I promised you at the beginning of saying, what really is the best way to look into this? Not even entirely obvious whether it's a good idea to start out with that generalized sharing box approach or to leap directly to a global system. One could imagine effects that might appear only in the global case here. Another one is to ask even what's the right initial state for best investigation of the physics. The simplest one is to lay down the material initially on a set of nested ellipses, all with the same eccentricity, all with the same orientation. You know, that's clearly the simplest way you could go about it. But will that capture the whole range of possibilities? The third one is, you know, the conventional initial magnetic field in MRI simulations, certainly in global simulations, has long been nested dipolar loops. And you can do that conveniently because the system's axisymmetric. Well, we're no longer axisymmetric. So it's not even clear as to what would be, quote, the most natural field topology. I'd add, by the way, that in the motivating problem, that are tidal disruptions, the initial field could well be predominantly toroidal, because if you imagine the star being pulled apart, whatever magnetic field it had initially gets stretched out in those tidal streams, and you know they will basically all lie in the orbital plane. But you know, that too remains to be seen, because at the moment, I think there is exactly one paper by James Gleeshaw and Michael McCourt on what happens to a magnetized star in a tidal disruption. And they carry out the simulation to a time at which the star has been pretty thoroughly stretched, but it's much shorter than the orbital time. And, you know, indeed, you see those field lines stretched along the streams, but we don't know what happens after. So that is actually all I have to tell you. You've heard my motivation for getting interested in it. You can see why this particular context yields really extreme eccentricities, where all the special effects of ellipticity in the orbits would be especially important. And to my mind, what it motivates is thinking about an extension of the whole MHD internal stress story to this more complex situation. And Svea and Edwin and I are just starting to think about how to do that. And here are my conclusions. I'm listening to you.
I haven't an opinion to your first question on the previous slide.
Okay, now we should go back to it.
I have the impression that the generalized sharing box model, the eccentricity is tied in, so there is no way you can damp eccentricity in a sharing box.
That's right. So, I didn't say it was good for everything.
Yeah.
But it might, I was thinking, and that's one of the difficulties that it poses. The thing is,
if you do have a parametric instability growing in this box, there is no way it's going to damp the eccentricity, which is what it should do in a real global system.
How do you know it should?
Well, that's what is exciting, the instability. So in principle, instabilities tend to damp whatever is exciting them, as a general rule of thumb.
I think it's a good rule of thumb, but I'd like to see it demonstrated. But yes, I agree with you that I think the shearing box might be good for looking at the initial stages of growth of the MRI, but it certainly cannot take you into the sort of epoch at which it's really doing things to the orbits.
Mm-hmm. to be any other orbiting material in the system when the disruption is?
Interesting question. I would say not. You know, nothing's guaranteed. You could imagine, for example, that if this is a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy, that after all, a few percent of them have hefty disks around them because they're currently operating as AGN. So that's certainly an example of when there would be other material around. But then there's the other, quote, 97%, where there's very little. If you imagine the amount of gas around Sag A star within, let's say, 100 RG or 1,000 RG, it's going to be a tiny fraction of the solar mass.
Neil, AGN black holes do rotate significantly. So yes. Solvent isn't planar.
Yes.
So, well, all sorts of other effects. You mentioned that string comes to play, but what do you think happens then?
Oh, gosh. I feel weak enough predictive power about the simple planar case. So absolutely, that's interesting. I'm quite unsure. I think in terms of just the hydrodynamics, it is possible to investigate the initial assembly of the accretion flow in the context of some orbital plane that's oblique to the spin and so on. But I'm not sure how the MHD would go along with that.
Well, one possibility among others is, I suppose, you might be able to ignite a jet
right.
If magnetized conductor.
No.
And there's some observational claims relative to jets and some.
Yeah, there are two events, which really do look like relativistic jets, and they're hard to understand because the amount of magnetic flux on a garden variety star is much too small to support a strong jet. And at the moment, there are sort of two ideas floated, both of which I would regard as grasping at straws. One of them is that somehow the MRI does get going and generates enough field strength to support a jet. The other is to imagine that there's some pre-existing extensive array of magnetic flux attached to the black hole before the event. And as these streams go way out and loop back around, they somehow lasso that flux and bring it in close.
Any flux you put on the black hole in vacuum?
Some small amount of gas pressure. Just the paper is by Sasha Chekhovskoy and McKinney, and I forget usual set of co-authors. And what they imagine is that there's some sort of radiatively inefficient Sag A star-like flow prior to the event. It has the flux, holds the flux, and then you rope it in.
I mean, can they not just be radiatively driven jets? Does it need to be?
That's another possibility.
So I would agree that that's the one case where it's not a magnetically dominated outflow.
I wouldn't say we know much of anything about it, but just that's certainly in sort of all the contexts where that might be interesting, this is a good one.
Why do you consider the first possibility as grasping at straws as well, that the MRI gets going and then launches the jet?
I think there are two problems. One of them is that in these observed cases, the jet seems to be there right at the start. And I said, unless you have a very unusual star, it just doesn't have enough flux to drive a magnetically supported jet. And so then you rely on the MRI to build it, but that takes a number of orbital periods. And we see these things turn on, and...
But what do we see when it turns on? I mean, it turns on when accretion happens, right?
Yes, but I guess...
Otherwise, before
but they
that,
turn on bright.
Right?
They turn on bright.
Yeah, but isn't that the moment that, you know, MRI maybe has been established already? The actual disruption starts earlier?
Yeah, I understand. But it'd still take a while to build up, I would think. And also to bring that, and whatever flux it generates has to be brought down to the horizon.
Sure.
Also takes time.
But could that time occur without any strong emission? I mean, that the moment when we start seeing them is the moment that...
Well, this is why we... There was a very nice paper by Jim Peeble some years back in the context of cosmology, where he evaluated a bunch of rival theories in terms of the number of tooth fairies required to make them work. Yeah, you have to put in... Somehow you have to... In all of these cases, you have to put in something special by hand.
We live by the eccentricities, right?
Yes, that, you know, you could, but you need to solve that problem too.
So a small percentage of stars do have magnetic fields that are orders of magnitude higher than typical stars. Is the magnetic field in a A star, B star, a magnetic A, B, or B star, is that large enough to turn on a jet?
You know,
maybe 100 times larger
field. I haven't
field
done than the numbers. Is anyone here more expert than I on magnetic A stars?
Field strengths at the surface of kilogauss or a few kilogauss.
I remember the argument being that even that was like a factor of 10 times too little flux.
You're getting close.
I mean, using the most magnetized star you
have. The problem then is the rate.
Sure, but those are maybe a few percent of stars, I don't know, and you could argue they produce the brightest events, so there is some selection effect to see those.
What fraction of all A stars are magnetic?
5 to 10%. Yeah.
What fraction of all stars are A?
You pointed out that these TDEs preferentially seem to occur at E plus A.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's certainly true.
The A's may not be in the right place.
But there is also this selection effect. If those produce the brightest events, you might see them much more often than the normal dim TDE.
Right, but then that means the rate would be, overall, would be terrific. Yeah. But, you know, modulo...
Well, the rate of interactions with the supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy is pretty high. If you look at the runaway B stars, way too many for...
Yeah, well, in fact, what I was going to say is that, putting aside for the moment the odd connection to E plus A systems, and just sort of washing it out, the nominal observed rate is somewhere in the neighborhood of a few by 10 to the minus 5 per galaxy per year. And oddly enough, that's not very different from the estimated rates people calculate from dynamical considerations. They tend to get numbers of 10 to the minus 5 to a few 10 to the minus 4. Now, given the unusual situation of the E plus A's, it does suggest that in those galaxies, the rate per galaxy per year is much higher, and correspondingly, the rate in everyone else is down. But
yeah. Well, I mean, another respect in which this eccentric disks are rather different, the scenario you present, the view from normal circular disks, you have these standing shocks, which are mildly relativistic. Have you tried to estimate how much energy you might be able to put into cosmic rays? Those shocks?
No.
Whether whether that could conceivably lead to an observable signal.
Pions
decaying.
I have certainly.
Desperate, I agree.
I've not done that calculation. Now, this is really dense stuff. It's a star, after all.
Initially, but it gets stretched out along the orbit, as you say, this after mass returns on this, as I recall, during the estimates.
Yes. That's right. The orbital timescales are generically months. The vertical optical depth out at that, the sort of epicenter scale, is still fairly large. I think Thomson units, I forget, hundreds, something like that.
Sure, but once a baryon gets, you know, becomes super thermal, it doesn't see the photons
I think, anyways, I certainly have not estimated relative to particle acceleration. What we have done with these simulations is actually measure the heating rate. And that heating rate at peak actually corresponds pretty well to the observed optical luminosity, and the temperatures out there would also correspond to emission in the optical or near UV. So that may be the explanation for the optical light we see, and that's sort of 10 to 43, 10 to 44 ergs per second, and, you know, lasting for a few months. I guess you can now divvy that up amongst GeV protons and see how many it might make.
So what's the luminosity in Eddington minutes for the peak?
Assuming, quote, typical galactic center masses of 10 to the 6, several 10 to the 6, that's maybe a little less than Eddington.
And the accretion rate?
Let me go back to that cartoon I drew. And it's important here to remember that these are intrinsically transient systems. So there is no single accretion rate. There is a rate of mass return. That's the t to the minus 5/3 fall off that I mentioned earlier. But then the stuff, you know, goes into this mess. And let's see. In this particular simulation, what we found was that over the course of the first six or eight characteristic orbital periods, the orbital period of the most bound material, as material passed through here in this shock, a total of maybe 30% of the bound mass of the star was actually deflected inward and would go to small enough radius that if you wave your hands and put in some alpha, it would accrete onto the black hole in a reasonable time, shorter than the characteristic period. The question there is that accretion rate probably is several to 10 times Eddington. And then you have all the questions about the effectiveness of cooling. To what degree are photons trapped? To what degree is the heat carried off in magnetically buoyant elements? How long does it take the MRI to ramp up in that region, which it really is closer to circular, et cetera? Okay. Now, while all that's going on, they said you have the 2/3 or 70% of the material, which ends up in a big mess out in this region, or bigger mess out here. That's the stuff whose heating rate, I said, was sort of 10 to the 43, 10 to the 44 ergs per second. And it's unclear even what kind of accretion rate to associate with it, because, as I said, we don't really know at what point and to what level internal stresses grow. What we can do is get the heating rate from those shocks.
Can the star's denser core ever survive disruption?
Yes. I guess one way to put it is that, of course, a cross-section increases for larger passages with larger paracenters. And if the paracenter is out to something like 1.5 times the tidal radius, defining the tidal radius as the largest paracenter such that the entire star is disrupted, then there can be partial disruptions in which the outer layers are lost, but the core does survive. But it's pretty sensitive to the exact value of the paracenter. When you get up beyond sort of 1.5 to 2, it's, you know, 100% preserved, and inside one, then it's, you know, all torn apart.
What do we know about the population of stars that's being disrupted? I mean, I think we heard that they're in older galaxies, that there are some giants.
Yeah, that shrug is one. I should say one of the fun things about this field is that it's sort of Wild West. There are a lot of interesting questions that really nobody knows the answers to, and maybe there is some low-hanging fruit.
They certainly expect a correlation with the central black hole mass, right? I mean, if the black hole mass in the center is smaller, right, you expect different types of stars to be also be disrupted or not be disrupted or do a direct bunch in. So as we get more events, one of the things to look at is, of course, what are the characteristics of the TDEs as a function of the central black hole mass?
Of course, it would be nice to actually measure the central black hole mass. Sometimes, in some of these cases, after the fact, you can go back, measure the bulge dispersion, and get an estimate that way. But,
Julian, how many cases do you think there are now?
Of tidal disruptions?
Yeah, legitimately.
Right. I think you're right to phrase it in terms of a confidence factor. There are some where I think the confidence factor is really, you know, well above 90%. There's some where I think the confidence factor is 2%. But if you sort of, you know, roll off and you integrate over the distribution, probably 15 or 20 now.
And that 90%. Yeah, I got
there are
15 and 20. That's
I'd awesome. Say certainly of order 10 that are pretty solid cases. And what I mean by solid is that these are events in which you see, in, say, most of the observations are optical or near UV. There are two that were detected by SWIFT. They're the ones thought to be jets. Bizarrely, SWIFT has been in operation for, 15 years now. Both events were in 2011. But so if you look at the majority candidates detecting the optical and UV, so you see them typically start out pretty bright and then decline over some span of months with people assert that the light curves are power laws t to the minus 5/3. The closer you look, the snagglier it gets usually.
Not that you necessarily expect them to be 5/3 anyway.
Yeah. I wouldn't personally expect the optical light to be t to the minus 5/3 until fairly late in the game, when basically what you're seeing is here. But in the observing community, it's considered a religious obligation to fit to t to the minus 5/3. So I would rather put it as some sort of gradual decline over a period of months, and little to no evidence that there's an AGN in this system. Some of the sort of 50% confidence cases might actually be AGN.
And with spectra, they don't look like any of the bright super.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the many of the surveys for these are done by people with a strong interest in supernovae. So that's the first question they ask.
Is there any prospect of using a TDE to measure the black hole mass? I mean, if you could measure something about the shock properties, could you say anything about the black hole mass?
How about the spin? Sorry, he was just quite on the serious side. I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, I know. If we understood this a whole lot better. What interests me about the response so far is that there's been actually much more interest in the tidal disruption story than I expected, and much less in the question of just what does happen to the MRI in an eccentric disk.
It almost seems like there's not time for the MRI to get going.
Well, certainly it will be. You'd be watching it grow.
I was wondering, have you seen the magneto elliptic instability?
What do you mean?
And I mean, if it would work in this disk?
Oh,
because if the streamlines they are elliptical, then you would have growth of the elliptic modes. So has there been articles about that in this field? Because we have looked at that in protoplanetary disks in connection to vortices in disks. In this case, then it could be a mechanism that would be at work that would change the MRI.
Okay. The part of the answer is no. No one's ever mentioned it. The other part is, I'd like to hear more about what this is, because this is the first time I've heard about it.
There are papers about that, Leibowitz and Zweibel, 2004, Mizerski and Bayer, 2009,
okay.
Myself and Huber Klar, 2011, uh-huh. And also myself and Christoph Mizerski, 2012. So we can talk more about
and the basic physics behind it?
It's the same as the thing that I was working on in 1991. So it goes back to the fluids community.
Even earlier?
Jaron Baer and Bailey in the late 80s.
Okay.
Yes.
And so I was working from that paper in 1991. The original elliptical instability was an elliptical distortion of uniform rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in problems like this, you have distortion,
yeah. And the magnetic connection here?
Well, so I don't know too much about that. Gordon Fogelby looked at that, I think, in his thesis. Basically, magnetic fields can destroy the elliptical instability because it changed the dispersion ratio. Depends how strong they are, but quite. Elliptical instability is basically an incompressible instability which can operate on a very small scale. So if you add even a little bit of field, mm-hmm. you can modify the frequencies of the modes that are being parametrically so much that they're no longer resonant.
Okay, now how does that relate to what he was just saying?
There are actually two main modes. I mean, one is actually, the horizontal mode of the magneto-elliptic instability is equivalent to the MRI. It's just that you have now both shear and then also the strain field from the ellipticity. And the other one is a resonance between alpha modes and other waves in the disk. I mean, alpha modes and the strain field,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So maybe that could be a perforation in these disks, and the growth rate goes up a bit in comparison with the MRI. Mm-hmm. So you have growth and like in even faster time scales than the MRI does. We can talk more about it afterwards, and then since it's
certainly seems
more people participating.
More comments or thoughts? Okay, let's thank you again.